The service we're using this morning, as you note in your worship order, comes from the Handbook for Congregationalism by Henry Martin Dexter, one of our eminent scholars of the 19th century. And I liked what Dexter said about at the beginning about, you know, a church that is doubly able to both chant the Our Father and not have a choir. Even though we had acquired choirs by then, he still was old-fashioned enough not to want one. But I'm glad we've got one, and I'm sure glad we've got a bell choir. Thank you very much. They were wonderful. So now this is Needful Notices, the points of the announcement. And I just want to highlight a couple of things. Green sheet goes where? Oh, very good. You may all have a cookie for saying that at coffee hour. There are plenty of them. Please also note, senior PFers, there's a time change, 6:30 this evening for senior PF. And then also note, on Thursday, there will be the meeting of the Wisconsin Congregational Theological Society, which is a whole lot more fun than it sounds, is going to be here at First Church. And we will meet at 6 and wander down the hill to Noodles, and thus support also, inside your green sheet, Greater Tosa Interfaith at the same time. And then we'll wander back up here for 7:30. So if you can't join us for dinner, come at 7:30. And it's open to everyone. And we have this week, it's Reverend Chris Bryan from Pilgrim Church, just up the road, is going to be speaking to us about coming to a manageable orthodoxy for the National Association. It should be exciting. If you've never been in a good theological roundhouse, come on. We love each other, but we argue, and it's great fun. I would also point you to the support, the special offering for Thanksgiving, and just note that it's going down to help our work, our ongoing work in Jardín America in Argentina, where we are a major support, down to Beloit, to Caritas Food Service. And then we'd like to do we do every year an in-kind donation in addition to a monetary donation. So we do an in-kind in the spring, in the fall, and an in-kind and a monetary in the spring for our own local food pantry. And in years past, haven't we, Richard, put a truckload and a half? I'd like to make two truckloads this year, two pickup truckloads of food. So bring in those canned goods and let's help those who are not doing as well as we are. And then please note, if you're bored with each other after Thanksgiving, on the 27th, they will be showing the drive-in movie Up. We'll be here at the church, and so we hope that you will have that. And then my final point is this. We're doing Hanging of the Greens different this year. Now, you may say, why is he talking about Hanging of the Greens now? Well, I turned on the radio in the car the other day, and there was Brenda Lee singing Rocking Round the Christmas Tree. And I almost had a stroke. We truly are now in this new season that one of my colleagues has called Hallow Thankmas. But we still kind of do things the old-fashioned way here. And so what's going to happen is we do these historic worship services. Next Sunday will be the last of those, and we'll worship as we would have in the 1940s, 1948 to be exact. And then we go back to normal. And on the first Sunday of Advent, Dr. Szymanski will be preaching. On the second Sunday of Advent, I will be preaching. On the third Sunday of Advent, Reverend Kwiatkowski will be preaching. And on the fourth Sunday of Advent, we will worship together in the traditional service of 9 lessons and carols to get us revved up for Christmas. And so we will be hanging the greens on the afternoon of the first Sunday of Advent. Bring your old clothes. Well, wear your old clothes. It's the one time you can come really dressed down. Bring your work gloves and come and help us hang the greens in the church. The deacons will be very happy to have you, and especially big, strong men that can help us put up 14-foot Christmas trees. And then afterward, after the service, we'll do it in the course of a service, we'll sing some carols, and then afterward we'll go out into the atrium and we'll have a wonderful time of fellowship with hot cocoa and hot cider. And by the way, if you've already started baking Christmas cookies, and if you haven't, hint, you might do so, please bring a plate of those. So that's all the needful notices at this time. Let us now turn our attention to the text. One of those long sermons. tell us, when will this be? And what will be the sign that all these things are about to be accomplished? As I read over the text, I thought that Peter, James, and John asked the question that is on the mind of every American investor when they hear Bill Gates and Warren Buffett talk about the impending end of the recession. When is it? When's it going to get here? What are the signs of the times? Let's face it, none of us like to wait. None of us want to wait. Simply, we get bored. We don't like it. It irritates us. And if we don't believe that that's the case, all you have to do is drive. And you'll see people who don't want to wait. All you have to do is go into a supermarket and try to get into the short line with the few items. And you'll see people who don't want to wait. Everywhere we go, there are people who don't want to wait. But on the other hand, what we like to do is, one, complain about waiting, and two, speculate about why we're waiting and when the end will come. And that's why one of the favorite things of human beings are conspiracy theories. That's how Dan Brown can write mediocre books that sell out. Oh, did I say that? Well, it's true. And meditations on the implications of the Mayan 5,000-year calendar coming to a close can become blockbuster movies with flying aircraft carriers and the world blowing up. None of us like to live in the kind of tension between what is and what will be, where we are forced to wait. But that is so much of our existence. Christians especially should understand this reality because theologians have dubbed it eschatological tension. Because we are living between the already of the inbreaking of God's kingdom that came in the incarnation of Jesus Christ and the not yet of the fullness of that kingdom. So we live in the in-between. Jesus answered the request for a handle on the future with a warning. Don't buy into predictions. He tells them, don't be deceived by those who say that the future is here. He couches his language, his answer, in the language of, of what is called apocalyptic, which is a biblical literature genre, which always has a predictive element, but really focuses on those who are going through difficulties and giving them comfort, saying, hang in. It promotes endurance. It promotes persistence in the midst of challenge, even persecution and change. And it says, hang in, hang in. God cares for you. God's with you. You are not alone. Hang in. Now, this isn't in my text, but I'm going to throw it in anyway, and there'll be no charge. The ushers won't come around a second time for the offering. And it's this. If you want to know why the book of Revelation was written, I'll tell you. It's because of the persecution of the Emperor Decius. The church was under persecution. The people were going through all kinds of change and difficulty, and they didn't know where help was coming from. And that mystical writing wasn't a predictive. It was, hang in. There is a greater one than the emperor in charge, and you're in his hands. Hang in and hang on. So Jesus tells his followers, and that would include us, that the world is off-kilter. Instead of being in relationship with the Creator God, instead of living out the covenant that God intended for it, the world lives in sinful isolation and in self-absorption. And it's fairly simple, isn't it, to turn on the television, to look at a newspaper or a magazine, to drive or to walk down the street to see evidence of what Jesus is talking about in abundance. Concern for the common good is minimal, even among those supposedly elected to promote it. Lack of concern for relationships beyond those that meet individual needs is everywhere. And all around us, we see self-centeredness that dishonors the covenant that God calls creation to live. And even the church, God's people, falls short in living out the covenant obligation of loving service that Jesus left us. Did anyone see the paper on Saturday morning with the sentencing of Tony Alamo, the evangelist, who had abused children in the name of Christ? and then had the audacity, as he was being sentenced, to use and hide behind religion again? You want to see me steamed? Show me that kind of stuff. The judge was so right when he says, "May the God who is a greater judge than I have mercy on you." So, when all of that is happening, and the people that are supposed to be doing the right are doing the wrong, is that what Jesus is talking about? Does that mean it's the end? Does that mean that after being wrong for all these years, Harold Camping, the civil engineer turned Bible teacher of family radio fame, who had predicted that the world would end in 1994, kind of backpedaled off that, and now has a book called Time Has an End, and says that the world's going to end in 2011. Or was Hal Lindsey, who wrote all of those late great Planet Earth books back in the 70s, was he right? I remember when I was in college, we had a course called Is It Really the End? It was on apocalyptic literature. And we read that book, and at the end of it, you know what we said? On the day that it was supposed to end, which was in September, we would meet for lunch, either in heaven or in St. Louis. And I will tell you that I had a glorious grilled salmon at the Cafe Balaban in the Central West End, where Sam Shaw is now hanging out. So I will tell you, I mean, are they on their way to reality because of this? I don't think so. Like Jesus says elsewhere in the Gospels and during his post-resurrection appearances in Acts, when they ask, when's it going to happen? He said, look, I don't know. And if I don't know, it's not given to you to know. Then what can we do? What difference can we make in the midst of so much change, in the midst of information overload like never before, of all of the stuff that's working us to shock us and to throw us off kilter and to do damage to our life together? In a parallel story, Jesus told his hearers in Luke's gospel, "In patience possess ye your souls." Eugene Peterson translates the text this way in his contemporary rendering of the Bible called The Message. And he says, it's staying with it. That's what's required. Stay with it to the end. You won't be sorry. You'll be saved. What we're to stay with is our profession of faith, our living out of relationship with God in Christ. It's being patient. It's living between the already and what is not yet that will make the difference. T.S. Eliot, the St. Louis-born British poet, muses on time quite eloquently in his wonderful poem, The Four Quartets. And he writes in East Coker, "I said to my soul, be still and wait without hope, for hope would be hope for the wrong thing." As Christians, we're always living between that already and not yet. We're already sharing the divine life. We're already experiencing a glimpse of heaven. But we know it's not full yet. So as one writer puts it, we find ourselves in the situation of the trapeze artist who lets go of the bar, but hasn't yet grabbed the other one. And we're kind of in between. We're living in air. And knowing that the bar will be there and when we need to grab it, but not until the time is right. And in the meantime, we're just there. In many ways, it's like the situation of Hannah, the mother of Samuel, one of those seen as the forerunners or types of the coming Christ. Barren, waiting for a child, longing for a child. She simply put herself into God's hands again and again. And she lives between the already of her situation of lack of fulfillment and the not yet of the joy of being a mother until the right time and her prayer is heard. Israel gets the prophet who will lead them toward important transitions into nationhood. And Hannah experiences the joy that she's longed for, all because she stayed focused on the one who held her, who indeed holds us all in loving relationship in the in-between, between the already and the not yet. Hannah's faithfulness is simply being with God and shows us the way that we can live between the already and the not yet. And you know how we do that? By living in the present, by living in the now, by appreciating the present moment and not constantly worrying about the future and living toward the future, about what it holds, and then also by not living in the past, constantly rehashing what happened and what might have happened. All I can think of is my old debate partner who used to say to me when I go into my what ifs, well, what if we'd done this? What if we'd done that? And he always called me Pazer. And he said, you know, Pazer, if ifs and buts was candy and nuts, we'd all have a Merry Christmas. We can't live in the what ifs, either of the future or of the past. We live in the present. We live in the between. Otherwise, if we focus on living toward the future or we focus on living in the past, we end up, as I heard someone once brilliantly say, shoulding all over ourselves. Pasting ourselves with all of the shoulds of life. We should have done this, and we should have done that, and we should have done that. Rather than getting on with the business of living. While we're not to become so future-oriented or so obsessed with what will be that we miss the already, we're also neither to live exclusively in past experience or to get so self-focused that we miss the promise of receiving what Eliot called the right thing. I came across some material that quoted the work of Esther Harding. She's called a personologist. I'd never heard of one before, one who studies the face. And she wrote a book called The I and the Not I. And in that book, Harding tells of an interesting story on the consciousness of animals. She said that scientists have discovered that each creature sees and hears only what concerns itself and is inattentive to all else. Every animal, in other words, lives in a world of its own. As an example, the study examined the life of a wood tick, which at certain times in its life cycle needs the blood of warm-blooded animals in order to reproduce. The wood tick, I found this fascinating. The wood tick will attach itself to the bark of a tree and wait for a likely host to pass by. With many ticks in the woods and far fewer warm-blooded animals to walk by, the wait for some wood ticks has been as long as 17 years. And during that time, there is nothing else that meets the need of the tick and nothing else to which it responds. It sits there until it gets what it wants. God, that reminds me of some people I know. Harding, of course, extrapolating from the study, says that even though humans have a higher consciousness than lower animals, this enclosed worldview persists in our day-to-day environment as well. We tend to see only what concerns us, only what meets our needs. We tend to turn off or ignore the things that we deem irrelevant to our situation. And this immediately, and forgive me if you use these things, I'm not condemning you, but they immediately reminded me of some of my students who live on their computers and their iPhones and their Blackberries. We walked down a chapel the other morning, I looked over and there's this one kid walking along like this. And I said, do you ever live apart from that? He said, well, it's a little hard. Texting away. Absolutely, I can't get my fingers to move that fast. Absolutely oblivious to everything going on around them, and all because they're wired to be receiving a steady stream of information. By opening ourselves to life in between, we can become attentive to a far greater reality than even the internet. We can have come to understand greater needs. Indeed, we can come to read the signs of the times that can draw us into a greater awareness, not only of God, but of ourselves. We may indeed be suffering from TMI, too much information, from information overload. But there is information that is life-giving. There is information that is productive and life-changing. And our faith, which is called Evangelion in the Greek, good news, is that information. The whole point of the gospel, the whole core of our Christian faith, is the spread of good news about a God whose love for the created world is boundless, about the change that God has brought to the world and to life in Jesus Christ, about a God whose will for humans is wholeness and fulfillment in oneness and communion with God and each other. Now that good news, that information needs to be shared. But somehow we Christians have become stuck in a rather negative rather than positive mode when it comes to the essence of our faith. And quite frankly, that needs to change because there is more positive thou shalt than the negative thou shalt not in the good news. The positive mode of Christian life is actually found when we abandon ourselves to God's will, to God's grace, to God's love. The 18th century writer, spiritual writer, Jean-Pierre de Caussade, understood this, and he made it clear in his masterful and challenging little book, Self-Abandonment to Divine Providence. I've talked about it before. And his point is that it is not in multiplying devotions, not in looking for greater complexity in our prayer life, that we will find the simplicity which will lead us to the one who is ultimate simplicity, and that's God. The way to do this is to give oneself to God at each moment of the day, and in that giving, in that abandonment or surrender, we will enter into what he calls the sacrament of the present moment, that reality that's right behind the reality that we see. And in that moment, we will discover the God who is always there, the Creator God, the God of the burning bush, the God whom Jesus addressed in very familiar terms, because God is always here. God is always around us. If we take the time to open the eyes and the ears of our heart to see and hear God. Now, the key to this sacrament of the present moment is simplicity. The word simplicity comes from the Latin simplex, and it just means one-fold. It lies in our being intentional, then, about seeing and about hearing God in the ordinary. Christian spirituality, my dear ones, is not rocket science, because at its core, it's simply being intentional. It's simply being deliberate in making sure that we give each moment to God and we open ourselves to what God is leading us to say, leading us to do, indeed leading us to be each day. My grandmother, God rest her soul, taught me a prayer as a little boy that I say, to be honest, almost every day before my little fat feet hit the carpet as I get out of bed. And you know what it is? All I do this day, I do to the honor and glory of God. I've told you about this prayer before. All I do this day, I do to the honor and glory of God. A prayer like that, as simple as that, at the beginning of the day, as straightforward as that one, can make all the difference if we're intentional. And if periodically during the day, we stop for a moment here and there and we center ourselves, we call ourselves back to that reality. So in the midst of the flood of information, in the midst of the sea of change all around us, all we have to do is stop for a moment. Maybe with a quiet cup of coffee or a cup of tea, find a little quiet place and say to God, I know you're here. I'm here too. Thank you. That's all it takes. And then we'll find ourselves in the present moment of God's love. God's love can help us to embrace even the negative aspects of our lives and to bring about change, positive, life-giving change as a result. Jesus' disciples heard him. They saw his life. They witnessed his death and resurrection. And it changed them. And they went out as changed people and in turn began to change the world, often in the face of life-threatening opposition. They were consistent. They were persistent. And God bless their efforts. The key then is to have our lives enfolded and grounded in God's life, to live within that covenant of presence. God's transcendent love can be so transformative that even the negativity of persecution or of sickness or of sorrow or even of death can be endured and, yes, can be overcome. Jesus not only told us the truth, my friends, he lived it. He lived it and he modeled it for us. So we can live between the already and the not yet. We can live open to God and open to others. We can deal with the flood of change all around us because a profound change has already occurred deep within us. A change that aligns our life with God's life and flows out of God's love. I'm no prophet, and I have no pretensions of it. Yet I will tell you that there is one way and only one way only to know the future. And that's to live in the present, to live in the present moment, to live in God's presence and God's present. One of my favorite theologians of the 19th century, John Henry Newman, put it this way. This then is to watch, to be detached from what is present and to live in what is unseen. So by coming to the moment of present, we then cross into the unseen, which is the presence of God all around us. Then we will always know when the things will come to pass. Because it doesn't really matter. All that matters is God. To live every day in God's presence is the only way to deal with life in between, life in eschatological tension, the living between the already and the not yet, and that is always being born into the fullness of God. May it always be so for us. May it always be so.